We're live and we're local. This is a Juno afternoon on Monday, January 22nd, 2018. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, filling in for Scott Burton. On today's show, CBJ Emergency Programs Manager will talk to us about Juno's emergency alert system. We'll find out about this weekend's Platypus Con. Lori Soa will be here to outline the call for artist designs for downtown city banners. And Sherry McDonald will update us on art workshops at the Color Wheel. Those interviews, national native news, bird note music, and more right here on a Juno afternoon. And taking a look at weather, it's currently 31 degrees at the Juno International Airport. We've got snow showers, total accumulation today, 1 to 2 inches. And tonight, more snow showers likely, another 1 inch of accumulation. Lows around 27. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women was brought to the forefront over the weekend at a women's march in Billings, Montana. Jackie Yamanaka of Yellowstone Public Radio reports.
Native women, children, and men with hand drums led the women's march through downtown Billings. Marcy McLean, a member of the Blackfeet tribe, was pleased the organizers elevated this issue to the greater community.
We need to talk about it more. We need to hold people accountable, making sure we're looking for the young women and the older women and the men when they go missing, making sure our law enforcement is equipped and funded to conduct the searches appropriately and conduct the investigations appropriately so that we can bring justice to families.
McLean is the executive director of the Montana-based social justice organization, Western Native Voice. She says Native Americans have to speak up and speak loudly on this issue and other issues. For National Native News, I'm Jackie Yamanaka in Billings, Montana.
The issue was also addressed by speakers at a march in Idaho, says Choban News editor Lori Edmo.
There was also a display set up. Sally Monday from the Shoshone Paiute tribe had a display because one of her nieces was murdered here in Fort Hall, and they're still trying to find her murderer. And so a number of the speakers talked about it and expressed the need to do further inquiry. And there were a number of signs by some of the Native women who displayed messages about it, and then also many of them were read in honor of the missing and murdered Indigenous women.
Women from across the state gathered in Boise on Sunday for the event. Essential services and programs are continuing during the federal government shutdown. The Senate failed to pass a funding bill last week and is scheduled to vote Monday to reopen and fund the government through early February. Leaders of Native organizations and tribes are closely watching and considering plans if the closure continues, especially for Indian health care. Cheyenne River Sioux Chairman Harold Frazier says for him it's another day of business as usual, but he is assessing needs.
Well, I don't think we're at that emergency stage yet. I know that a lot of the federal dollars have been drawn down in anticipation of this. You know, I think we're not at that point, but we do. What I'm going to do is do sit down with our reservation. I already did talk with IHS and ASHRQ. They're going to be going on because that's the main thing on our reservation is health care.
The Interior Department and the Department of Health and Human Services have contingency plans. Crews will soon begin assessment of 8 abandoned uranium mines near 2 communities on the Navajo Nation. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports it follows a settlement with the company responsible for the contamination.
Under the deal made with Enpro Holdings, radiation tests will be conducted along with surveys of biological and cultural resources at the sites in Cameron and Tuba City, Arizona. Crews will also install fencing and signs that warn of possible radiation exposure. 2 of the mines are on the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's high priority list, which includes nearly 50 sites with high radiation levels, potential for water contamination, or in close proximity to homes. The assessments will be made under the federal Superfund law and are expected to be completed by the end of the year. 30 million tons of uranium were mined on or near the Navajo Nation during the Cold War. Tribal and EPA officials have worked for a decade to evaluate the more than 500 leftover abandoned mines. To date, fewer than 10 have been cleaned up. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Dog musher Pete Kaiser won the Kuskokwim 300 race for the 4th time in a row. Kaiser from Bethel, Alaska, and his team claimed victory Sunday morning. The race is 300 miles across tundra and along the Kuskokwim River. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're tuned in to A Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and my first guest is Tom Matisse, CBJ Emergency Programs Manager. Welcome back to the show, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. You're here today to talk about emergency notifications, and one of the reasons you wanted to come in and talk to us is the recent false alarm that happened in Hawaii.
Right. We don't plan any of those anytime soon.
Phew, because false alarm is a bit of an understatement. That was like a life changer for a lot of people. I think people got that notification. I certainly would never forget it if it happened to me. So what's just to start off, what's your understanding of what happened there?
You know, that's a test screen, and somebody's got the job to push the real alarm, and right next to it is the button to push the test screen. So they were going through their procedures to pull it up and to make sure the system worked internally, and instead of doing it internally, they did it externally. Bad day.
Seems like a design flaw in the system, maybe?
I'm sure there will be a lot of things changed in the future.
Yeah. Well, super scary, even for us here, you know. And I found out about it after it was all over, but yeah. So I know a lot of Alaskans like me were thinking about what would happen if they got that notification. How do we make sure the emergency notifications that we get are 100% timely and accurate?
Well, emergency notifications quite a bit different here in the state of Alaska. We don't have a push button, a computer operated system to send push notifications to your phone. What you're going to find mostly is still the use of the emergency alert system, that TV crawler, that radio interruption. And please, please remember NOAA weather radios. Those are the best source of the emergency alert information. As you guys know, KTOO here is actually the home of the region's emergency alert. It starts here and pushes out to all the other radio stations and TV stations from here. So that's a great system, and it's nationally based and can be used at any time through civil emergency messages or for weather messages or for other purposes.
Where would we get one of those NOAA radios?
So, you know, all the stores in town tend to have them. You know, Western Auto, I know Fred Meyer's, I know a lot of the different electronic stores will carry them. You're just looking for a battery-powered. It can also plug into a wall charger as well, but it's the NOAA weather radio. And the beauty of those is when the emergency alert system goes off, even in the middle of night, even if that radio is turned off, the activation of the EAS actually turns on your radio. So you're going to get woken up, you're going to get the message, you're going to know what you need to do, and you're going to be able to go into action. Also, the EASs for the things that we have here in the community are never pre-scripted. That would be formed on the spot. So it's two people getting together, writing it up, putting it into the system, and then deploying the system.
I see. Now, does the city and borough of Juneau have the ability to send out a push notification to phones?
We only use push notification systems for the burn bans in the valley, and that is a pre-sign-up system. So the only way to do push notifications is through pre-registered systems here in the city. We can do push notifications, but not on an emergency basis. It takes a little more work than that.
So what happened in Hawaii just couldn't happen here.
That's right. I mean, what they have is a very, very expensive paid subscription that allows them to access those systems and to push those out.
And we're not paying for one of those, huh?
You know, I mean, it's just it's the recurring cost of a really, really large system that we've talked about, police and fire and the city and the state, and we look at how many times we would use that, and the number of uses is so limited for the expense, it's hard to justify.
There are still ways to get push notifications in the event of an emergency. Are there apps that you recommend or that you yourself use?
No, not really. I mean, once again, the emergency alert system here in Alaska is where you're going to get all the key information. Remember, your cell phones can go down in a big disaster as well. So we know even in Juneau, the cell phones get overloaded really simply. So.
Can you sort of walk us through the city's emergency notification alert system process? Like, what happens when there's a message that needs to go out?
So if there's a message that needs to go out, myself, the city manager, the police chief, or the fire chief all have the ability to push notifications. That's getting a scripted message to the National Weather Service that enters it into the system. And when they push the button on go, it comes through your KTOO stations and branches out through all the other radio and television stations, including NOAA Weather Radio and VHF Radio.
Wow, so it would start right here, huh? Well, yep. It would start with a couple people and then originate from KTOO.
That's correct.
Pretty cool. And is there a place, a resource, maybe CBJ, maybe otherwise, where folks can go to review recommended actions that you might want to take to protect yourself or your family in the event of a specific threat? Like, say you live on the outer coast and you want to plan ahead for a possible tsunami.
Well, you know, if you just look at emergency preparedness and talk about the few real simple things that you should consider, one is having that emergency go bag, right? Because I can't evacuate for a tsunami with the clothes on my back. I would prefer to have a go bag that had some essentials in it. Think about your prescriptions. Think about your eyeglasses. Think about some additional clothing or food or other things. Because if you do lose your home or the road system gets damaged or you're in a place that doesn't have good services, you're going to need everything you've got. So a go bag is a great place to start. Also remember, in the state of Alaska, because our lifelines are from the lower 48, you should have 7 days supply of food and water. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we try to continue to push on people here in Alaska to remember the importance of that. Most of us are very fortunate. I always say preparedness in southeast Alaska is a freezer full of salmon. So hopefully everybody got out this fall and went to Dipak and filled their freezer a little bit, too.
Not me. But are there designated places around town where people might go or gather in the event of emergency, safe places, shelters?
We do have designated shelters, but once again, you always want to know that the shelter has been announced, that it will be open, because, you know, that disaster could occur right now, but the shelter is not open right now. It takes us a few minutes to get the doors open, the lights on, get the Red Cross in there and everything going. When the shelters are up and operational, we'll definitely announce that. But Centennial Hall and the schools in the community are your primary shelters. And we know that a lot of our churches in the community have plans to help work with their population and shelter in place in those areas as well.
And what's the best source of information if we want to learn more about emergency preparedness or CBJ's resources?
Ready.alaska.gov is actually a really good place to learn about emergency preparedness for the state of Alaska. It's more regionally specific than the national ready.gov. It's just a great place to find all kinds of documents, family preparedness plans, family communications plans, checklists, and other things you should be thinking of.
Cool. Well, my guest is Tom Matisse, CBJ Emergency Programs Manager, talking to us about emergency notifications. Is there anything else you'd like the folks that are listening to know?
Just be safe out there. It's snowing. Always good to see that. The roads are getting a little bit slick this evening. Hopefully Mother Nature will keep sending some snow so we can get playing in the mountains more again this winter, and you can start hearing from me on the avalanche side as well.
Yeah, that would be nice. I'm hoping the Eagle Crest update is a little bit different this week.
Keep your fingers
also,
crossed.
The sidewalks are kind of a mess, too, so be careful out there. I echo that sentiment. Tom, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Welcome to the quarterly meeting of the William J. Erickson Individual Native Corporation, or WINC as I like to call it, board meeting inside my head.
William's high-pressure job and unusual coping method backfires when his imaginary board of directors hijacks his real life. William Inc., by Inupiaq playwright Lucas Rowley, is a world premiere at Perseverance Theater, January 24th to February 17th. Tickets at Hearthside Books, The Jack, ptalaska.org, and 463-TIXS.
It is 17 minutes after the hour. You're listening to A Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and my next guests are here to talk about PlatypusCon. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Hi.
Thanks.
Could you please introduce yourselves and explain how you are connected to PlatypusCon?
I'm Josh Warren. I'm the president of Platypus Gaming, and we're the ones who put on PlatypusCon.
And I'm Shay Wilson. I'm on the board of Platypus Gaming.
What is Platypus Gaming?
We're just a nonprofit that got organized because we wanted to share our love of board gaming with the town and with other people we'd heard like board gaming. So,
what's behind the name Platypus Gaming?
Platypus is my favorite animal, and I wanted it to be something unique instead of just JunoCon.
Cool. I like the logo, too, by the way.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
It looks great on a T-shirt. All right, so what's new and exciting on the board game scene?
There's lots of new games every year. There's over probably 1,000 new games that come out every year, and we're always having a hard time keeping up, but we always have our favorites.
It seems that co-op's big on the board game scene right now with Pandemic Legacy and my favorite current game, Magic Maze.
Ooh, I've not heard of that one. I have played some new ones that I never heard of before over the holidays, you know, with friends. There was a game called Quirkle. You guys ever played that one?
Yeah, we actually have a giant set at PlatypusCon, so each of the tiles is about a foot by foot.
Cool. Quirkle's like Scrabble, but with shapes and colors. Kind of the same concept. And then Anomio, it's a card game.
I've heard of that one, but I don't think we have that one, actually.
Yeah.
We'll have to find.
Do you guys have a sense of what's most popular in Juneau or in Alaska?
There's not. We don't have like an overarching feel of Alaska. Catan's always really popular. Co-op games are popular.
What are some of what are some new games that are awesome that you guys like a lot that folks might not have heard of?
Shay already mentioned Magic Maze that just came out this year. Just this last weekend, I played Kitchen Rush, which is sort of trying to simulate a kitchen app. All the workers you use are hourglasses.
Oh, that sounds fun. Really Bad Art is a really fun one that I like.
Yeah, you only have 6 seconds to draw and do a good job or passable at least.
It's bad.
Like super fast Pictionary?
Yeah.
All right. So tell us what will be happening at PlatypusCon. What should people expect when they arrive?
We have a library of over 1,500 games that you can check out and play. We know most of them and can teach most of them. We have tournaments going all weekend. One of them is a qualifier for the National Championship for Catan. We have some other contests going on that I'll let Shay talk about. So
we have a in years past we've had find the game component, so it's a picture of all the different pieces from games and you have to identify it, and then we have several one panel games, and we have a hidden contest we started last year and are continuing this year. Hopefully it goes over well.
A hidden contest?
Yeah, it's hidden. You have to find it.
You have to find the start and then keep going. We also always have Play to Win, which is always one of the most popular things. We'll have around 20 games that all you have to do is play it and fill out a card, and you're entered to win a copy at the end.
And this year, new is our children's section, where we've separated the children's games so they can have their own area to play.
Yeah, and find them easier.
Cool. Are there any booths or exhibitors, sponsors, things like that?
I believe Alaska Robotics is joining this year. We're slowly filling our britches, so this is the first step into that direction. But we don't have too much in that direction yet.
We have several local sponsors, and the Escape from Alaska should be down talking to people about her escape room.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I did that one over in the fall. What other kinds of tournaments will you be holding besides the Settlers of Catan?
We have 10, including Catan. We have Dimension. We have Skull King. I'm not going to list them all, so you can stop counting. Nevermore.
Diamonds.
They'll all be in the program, which might be helpful to look at.
Great. Where can we find the program?
Well, the program will be at the door.
I see.
But it'll be a good thing to look in it. Just a helpful hint.
Is there some of that on the website?
Yeah, if you go to platypusgaming.org and then go to our game library, there's a list of the events that are happening over the weekend.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Josh Warren and Shay Wilson. They are here telling us all about Platypus Con. When and where is it happening?
It is happening this weekend, starting at 6 p.m. on Friday, going till 2 a.m. And then on Saturday, it starts at 10 a.m. and goes to 2 a.m. again. And then Sunday, we start at 10 a.m. and go to 6 p.m.
And it's at Centennial Hall.
What he said.
Yeah, and so the late-night gaming, that sounds like a lot of fun. Has that always been a part of Platypus Con?
We've always gone that late. We used to go earlier. We decided to be a little bit more sane. But I've always been a night owl, and I like playing games late into the night. So.
And this is the fourth annual Platypus Con.
Yep.
So are you expecting anything, a bigger turnout, same as last year?
Well, we moved over to Centennial Hall from the Jack, so we hope we can... We sold out last year, and we hope we can fill more people in.
Great. So should folks get tickets in advance?
I'd highly suggest getting tickets in advance. We sold out last year, and while the Centennial is a bigger space, we've been growing quite a bit every year. So I'd anticipate we'd sell out again. So.
Well, that is really exciting. Platypus Con sounds like a ton of fun. Thank you both for your efforts to organize it and coordinate it. Is there anything else you'd like to add or you'd like everybody to know about?
I always make sure to mention that we are definitely new person welcome. We know we have lots of simple games, and we're ready to teach them. So don't feel like you need to be a board game aficionado to come join and play with us.
And we can definitely find a board game that suits your personality. We've got 1,600 board games, so there's something for
I'm
you.
Pretty sure we can find one for you.
Well, that's great. Well, thanks so much for being here today, and have a great time this weekend.
Thanks.
Thank you.
is Bird Note. For birds, rain is a fact of life. They might take cover during a drenching downpour, but when it showers all day, they still have to brave it and find food. Chickadees still fly to feeders for sunflower seeds, right through a cold winter rain. Fortunately, a bird's outer layers of body feathers, known as contour feathers, prevent rain from penetrating toward its core. The fine structure of contour feathers interlocks each feather with the next, creating a barrier to water, keeping it from reaching the down feathers where birds trap air for warming insulation. Many birds also apply an oil to their feathers while preening, using their bills to spread oil from a gland at the base of the tail. The oil isn't so much a waterproofing substance as a conditioning lubricant that keeps feathers supple, allowing their fine structure to mesh and repel water. Birds that don't have an oil gland, like parrots, grow special down feathers that disintegrate into a very fine waxy substance called powder down. When preened into the contour feathers, powder down also helps repel water. So, bring on the rain. It's warm and dry under those feathers. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Support for Bird Note comes from Bloomsbury, announcing the new book Winter Birds, with paintings by artist and ornithologist Lars Johnson, available wherever books are sold.
Support comes from the Rainforest Cottage in downtown Juneau. Two furnished and equipped apartments with off-street parking available for short and long stays. Details and reservations at JunoRainforestCottage.com.
You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon. It's the bottom of the hour. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and here in the studio with me are Lori Soa and Lisa Egan Lagerquist from the City and Borough of Juno. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. And you're both project managers for the city, and you both have different projects that you want to talk about today. Lori, we're going to start with yours.
Okay.
You're here to talk about the call for artists to submit designs for downtown banners. What are the reasons that the city wants to replace the current banners?
Well, we, as most people know, we're in the middle of a downtown streets reconstruction project. So we're in the second year of a three-year project. Last spring, we reconstructed South Franklin Street from Admiral Way up to the intersection at Front and Franklin Street. And this year, we're going to be doing Front Street and North Franklin. And as we do that project, we're modernizing the lighting system downtown. So we're replacing the old high-pressure sodium light poles that are there with their black, historic-looking LED light poles. And while we're doing that, it's time for an update on the banners.
Cool. Well, that's a great reason. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit more about what the city's hoping for, what they're looking for with this call for artists?
Yeah, so we put out a call for artists. And you can go, if there are any artists out there that are interested, I encourage you to go and actually read the call for artists on the CBJ website, and I'll go ahead and give you that website right now. If you go to juno.org/engineering, on the left side of the page, there's a tab for bids and RFPs. If you click on that link, that's where you'll find the actual call for artists. And it'll be a three-part process. The initial submission is just basically a letter of interest from the artist and a resume, some references, and a portfolio of some of the work that they've done before. And that is due into the city by February 13th at 4:30 p.m. And then we have an art selection panel that we're currently putting together, and it's comprised of seven members, two members from the JAC, one member from the Historic Resources Advisory Committee for CBJ. Let's see who else. A member from DBA, the Downtown Business Association, one member from Sea Alaska, a member from the Filipino community, and then a member from the public at large as well. So this art selection panel will meet and take a look at the artists who have applied to be part of this process and select probably 3 to 5 artists to actually move on to stage two, which is concept development. And then those artists will go out and they will develop early stage development of concepts for banners downtown. And then we'll reconvene the art selection panel and take a look at those and then make choices as to how to move forward with either one or more artists for the final development of the banner designs.
Wow, that's quite a process.
It's a process, for sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
So as part of the, so first there's the letter of intent or letter of interest, and then do you have any information at this time about what format the work must be submitted into, or that's all part of the process?
Yeah, so
with the artist.
The initial stage where they're submitting a letter of interest, that's very well defined at this point in terms of what format everything needs to be in. It's going to be electronic copies through a CD or a jump drive or something like that. And then when the art selection panel meets, we'll put out some very specific guidelines in terms of what format we expect the art to be in. And generally, we're looking for something electronic. That way, it's easy to distribute to everyone.
Sure. And do you know how many designs will be selected? How many banners? How many different banners do you need?
We're pretty open at this point, but we're like up to 6 different designs.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
I really look forward to seeing these.
Yeah.
Do you know? Do the artists receive anything besides having their designs on display for participating in this?
So artists that are selected for actually developing concepts may receive a small stipend of $600. And then when we move to final design, there's a payment for that as well, too.
Cool. What are your tips for a good, solid design submission?
Well, we're early in the process, I think when the art selection panel comes together, we'll try to put out some really good guidance on what we're looking for. I think artists who are interested in participating, we're looking for folks who have experience with public art and potentially similar media to the banners that we're looking for.
Do you know when the new banners will go on display?
Well, as you said, it's a little bit of a process. We want to make sure we take our time and give everybody a chance to, submit ideas and designs and really vet them well. We're hoping if we move through the process as we currently have it scheduled that we'll have the actual final designs by mid-May this year. And depending on production, we could possibly see them at the end of the summer season, but most likely it's going to be next season.
So, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to take your time. Yes. Are either of you planning to submit a design?
No, we would not be allowed to as part of the this process. Well, Lisa maybe could.
Well, you wouldn't want my art up there. I'll leave that to some experts in art.
Do you know who some of the past designers have been?
Yeah, so I spoke with a fellow by the name of Gary Gillette, who works for our Docks and Harbors program, who was involved in previous banner designs. The original ones from the 80s were designed by a woman by the name of Heidi Snow, and they featured a series of Alaskan flowers, and I understand they were actually hand-sewn, but they had white backgrounds, and so apparently they got dirty fairly quickly.
Oh, yeah.
So the next round was done in the mid-90s, and there were a number of different artists that were selected, and so there were various designs from different artists that are part of the banners that you still see around town now, well, in the summertime when they're up. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to track down the names of all the different artists that were part of it, but I understand that Jane Tursis and Billy Ray were two of the artists.
Cool.
So,
and I'm sure folks listening probably know some other names, too. They can feel free to submit those to us.
Yeah.
So we'll get our research done.
That'd be great.
All right. So that's Lori's project, The Call for Artists. And tell me again, where can we find out more information about that in the application?
So if you go to CBJ's website, juno.org/engineering, the engineering webpage, on the left-hand side, there's a tab for bids and RFPs. I would give you the whole link, but it's giant and has lots of numbers. And that's the easiest place to go to look for any contracts that we have out to bid, and so there's a call for artists. The link is there, and you can download the PDF, and all the information is there, too. There's one other thing I should mention is that any artists who are interested should consider coming to, it's not mandatory, but we are having a pre-submittal meeting at the city at 10 a.m. this Wednesday, January 24th, and that will be on the third floor of the Marine View building downtown, and this is just an opportunity to come hear a little bit more about the process and ask any questions at that time.
Great. Thank you so much for all that information. That's really exciting.
Thank you.
I always love to see new public art.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it.
Yeah. All right. Well, now we're going to switch over to Lisa Egan-Lagerquist, who is also a project manager for the City and Borough of Juneau. You've got a different project that you're working on, so tell the good people all about it.
Thank you. So the project I'm here to talk about is Downtown Wayfinding and Interpretive Elements. And basically, you have probably been walking downtown and seeing the signs that direct you to different places.
Yeah.
But some of those, many of those are outdated, and things that have been built or changed names in the last 10 years are not included in that. So it's time to also update that those signs and add some interpretive signs. So we are in the request for proposal process of design process for this. And we hope to have a designer on contract in about a month. And ideally, we will have the designs for these new signs completed this summer or the fall. And then fabrication and installation would happen by the spring of 2019. However, we have funding for the design, but we do not yet have funding for the fabrication or installation. And we have funds have been requested from the marine passenger fees. So we're hoping that goes through because, I'm really excited about having new wayfinding and interpretive signs. I think there's a big need for it, and with all the new construction happening on Franklin and that Lori was just talking about, new banners, new signs, it would be great to have it together. So hopefully we'll get funding, and that will be decided in the next budget cycle.
Is that part of the draft recommendation that was just released?
I am not entirely sure, but I think so.
Okay. Well, if not, it is open for public comment. You can go and add your request. And you mentioned interpretive signs. What does that mean exactly?
So interpretive signs could be a lot of different things, and that will be part of what we'll be working with designers on, what we sort of want to focus on in the interpretive signs. But, for example, earlier there was a bunch of signs that talked about different architecture that was downtown, and there's some interpretive signs on the dock that talk about, I think there's a set that talk about lighthouses, and there's some that talk about the plains. So interpretive really is pretty broad and can just be anything to tell you more about the place you're in. And I should mention that this wayfinding project does not include signs on the seawalk because those are already being designed and planned in a different project. But whatever our designs are, they will definitely be complementary to what goes on the seawalk.
Oh, cool. Well, that is quite an undertaking, but I'm sure it'll go well. I, for one, really appreciate good signage. So thanks for coming in and telling us about that today. Is there anything else you'd like the people to know about this project?
This is really just sort of a heads up that it's coming, and we're excited to be working on it. And as we progress, we will eventually have some public meetings for input of different ideas.
Great. Speaking with Lori Soa and Lisa Egan-Lagerquist, both project managers for the City and Borough of Juneau, both have different projects that they're here to talk to us about, the call for artists to submit designs for downtown banners, and the wayfinding project. Both of you, thanks for being here today. Is there anything else you'd like to add or I've forgotten to ask you?
No, I will plug a little bit. I also, as I mentioned earlier, manage the Downtown Street Improvements Project, and it's a large construction project. And so we're looking at getting started on Front Street work probably beginning of March, end of February, if weather allows. So I'll probably come back here in a little while and tell you a little bit more about that one.
Oh, well, good. I hope that you do.
Okay.
Thank you both for being here today.
Okay. Thank you.
support comes from GCI Internet Services. GCI offers internet packages that include technical support 365 days a year. GCI, serving Juneau downtown on Seward Street and in the valley.
It's about 14 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and here with me in the studio is my next guest, Sherry McDonald, representing the Color Wheel Arts Studio. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks.
Yes, you're welcome. So, Sherry, tell us a little bit about the Color Wheel Arts Studio and what's your role there?
Well, the Color Wheel Arts is a new art studio in Douglas that I started last summer on my birthday. I got the official business license on my birthday in August. But since we've started up in October, we started selling classes, all different kinds of art classes, fiber arts, paper arts, jewelry, painting, just some different kinds of classes, and it's been really great. And then we took a little bit of a winter break. I went down to visit some family, but now we're back and starting up some more classes in January.
Cool.
Yeah.
Last time we had someone from the studio here, we talked about art classes that involved making paintings and ornaments with felt. So how did those go?
Oh, that was great. Yeah, that was Amy. She does all of the fiber art classes, and she does a great job. And people had so much fun making felted gnomes and snowman. And I had one young girl make a Star Wars BB-8. It was totally cute.
Cool.
Yeah, it was
That's
very
a
fun.
Good idea.
Yeah. But all those classes were really fun. Actually, Amy's going to be teaching some more classes in January. She's going to be teaching the cable knit headbands, and she's going to be teaching some crochet classes. So the cable knit headband is on January 24th, and the granny square crochet class is on the 31st. So those are going to be really fun.
Knitting and crocheting, making a pretty big comeback.
Yeah, and I love the little granny square class. You get to just make these. You can do so many things with them. You can use them for making a pocket on a cool old sweater, or, you know, making a little purses if you put them together. They're just really a fun and a good entry point into crocheting.
Yeah, you can make a whole quilt out of them if you're ambitious.
Yeah, ambitious for sure. Yeah.
I'm excited about the cable knit headbands. I love cable knit anything, so, and those look really cute.
I'm sure
the finished product is going to be, you know, get a lot of use from
Definitely.
The maker.
Yeah, and she makes all of the knitting needles for the classes, and then we supply all the yarn.
She makes the needles?
Yeah.
What does she make them out of?
Dowels and buttons for the toppers, and at the end of the class, if people want to purchase them, they can purchase the needles, too. But they get the yarn, obviously, part of the price.
Yeah. Well, that's a fun fact. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
You guys are just so artistic over there. Imagine that.
Yeah. And then also in January, I am teaching a bookbinding class. I'm teaching an accordion-style photo album book. We'll be learning the basics of how to fold an accordion, and then we'll be making these photo album books. So they'll be really fun.
Cool. Yeah. Well, all that sounds great.
Yeah.
And then you also have some workshops coming up, the 12 by 12 workshop.
Yes.
That sounds like a big deal.
I know. So the City Museum does this really great thing for the community every year. They have a 12 by 12 show in March. And to get people sort of warmed up and get pieces made for the show, because it's a general, you know, admission. You just pay like the 12 by 12 price, and then you get to have your piece in the museum. For the whole month, it's so awesome to have your artwork. I know I had my son do that one year. It was really fun for him to have his art in the museum. So I am teaching two classes to help get people ready for the museum show. So it's a 12 by 12 collage class on February 10th, and that's the adult class, and that's in the afternoon from 1 to 4. It's a Saturday. And then there's a kids class the following Saturday on the 17th. From 9 to 11. And the adult class is actually 14 years and up, and then the kids' class is 13 years and under. So it's pretty broad when they say adult class and kids' class. But the class is going to be awesome. When you leave the class, you will have a 12 by 12 piece of artwork ready to hang, so you don't have to do anything else to it. You're going to start off with some wood panels, and you'll be able to do your whole collage piece. We'll discuss, you know, some composition stuff when you're working with a square. And the theme this year is seasons. So it can mean a lot of different things. We're calling the class Seasons of Collage. But the word seasons is really interpreted by the artists. You know, it could be like the four seasons. It could be the sport seasons. It could be the seasons in your soup. You know, so we're trying to get people to just
like maybe think outside of what the seasons is and how to express that in collage.
And they'll be making the collage from clippings, like magazines and things like that?
Yeah, so the class will, there'll be clippings, there'll be magazines, there'll be some old books, some things with images inside of them they can cut and paste, and a lot of the kids might tend towards that, and some adults do, because collage has a really broad description. And so there'll be definitely some images. I'm encouraging people to bring images if they have things that are connected to what they think is their seasons of you know, the theme of seasons. We will also have regular, just solid colored papers. I mean, I'm a paper artist, and so I have a plethora of paper, and so lots of clippings and scraps and pieces and shreds. And so if people want to do an image that's like a landscape or whatever it is that they're doing, they can use both clippings of imagery or solid colors or a combination of
the
two.
Kind of make like a mosaic style.
Yeah,
image.
Right.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it'll be great.
Yeah, I'm an adult. I should sign up for that.
Yeah. And then afterwards, I have all like the hanging wire and stuff, so we'll put that on the back or give it to them so they can take it home and put it on the back. And then it'll just be ready to rock.
What, in your opinion, makes a good collage?
Oh, I feel like the collage is a process that is, it's about organizing images and feeling like connected to the paper, because I'm really into the texture and the feel of the fibers, because most of the collages I do are with solid color papers, and I'm creating an image with the solid color papers versus the cutting of, you know, pictures out of a magazine. And so for me, I think a good collage is about your connection to the material, and it has a very structural feel to it, because you're cutting versus just drawing something. Even though it's, you know, just 2D, it has sort of a three-dimensional feel to it, because you're cutting out the shape of an image. I don't know, what makes a good collage is just that connection you have to the materials, for me, that at least. Yeah, you know, and visually, you like it. It's appealing because it's, you know, paper.
And I guess if you don't like it, you can just put something else over.
That's the beauty of collage. You could just collage on top. I have so many collage pieces that have, like, layers. If you did, like, the x-ray thing, you know, you can see the different, like, collages that were underneath of the pieces that you didn't like, that you're like, I don't like the way that looks. Yeah, totally.
Well, that sounds like so much fun. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Sherry McDonald from the Color Wheel Art Studio, and she was just telling us about the 12x12 workshops that's happening in conjunction with the City Museum. And when and where is the workshop happening again?
So the workshop is in February. There's one on February 10th and one on February 17th, and one is for adults and one is for kids. And they're both held at my studio in Douglas at Color Wheel Arts, which is this 1112 3rd Street, right on Douglas Highway, right across the street from that automotive repair shop and next door to the Methodist Church, right on Douglas Highway, right down in the heart of Douglas.
And it's got a water wheel, right?
Yeah, it's called the Water Wheel Building. It used to have a water wheel, but it's not there anymore.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
No water wheel, but it's still called the Water Wheel Building.
Yeah, it's the Water Wheel Building. Which
now
is,
it's the Color Wheel.
Yeah, that's the generation. That's how the name kind of came together, was like, it's a Water Wheel Building. It's now the Color Wheel Arts Building.
So where's the best place to get more information about the Color Wheel Art Studio and the classes and the workshops?
Well, I do have a Facebook page. I don't have a website at this time, but I do have a public Facebook page, and it's just Color Wheel Arts on Facebook. And if you're not a Facebook person, but you know how to get around on the web, you can look at the Facebook page because it's public. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to access. And I usually try to pin some important information on the very front of the Facebook page, so you don't have to like look too deep to find stuff. So that's really the best. Or you can call me, or you can email me. My phone number is 907-209-7173. And I have to think about that. And my email address is Sherry, S-H-E-R-R-I, at SherryMcDonald.com.
Is that all one word, Sherry McDonald?
Yeah, Sherry McDonald's one word is M-C-D-O-N-A-L-D. You can also call the City Museum about the collage classes, if, or the, you know, if you have questions about that. piece of it or the entry piece or anything to do with it and they can't answer it, then they'll send you to me.
Okay, so, great.
And then also, before I forget, in February, we have one other fun class happening. It's similar to the felting class that we did in Christmas with the ornaments and things. We're going to do a wet felting class.
Ooh.
And Amy is teaching that again, and it's on the 24th of February. and it's a fun process. So all those people that took that needle felting class earlier in the, I guess it was last year, will probably enjoy learning another felting technique, and it's a wet felting technique. So.
Great. Well, thanks for mentioning that. Hopefully Amy can come back and tell us all about it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here today, Sherry. It all sounds like good stuff. I love hearing about art.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, good luck with the classes and good luck with the workshop. I hope to see you there.
All right, great.
Thanks for tuning in today to a Juno Afternoon. Today's guests were CBJ Emergency Programs Manager Tom Matisse, and we also heard from Platypus Khan and Lori Soa and CBJ Program Manager Lori Soa and Lisa Egan Lagerquist about their projects, Call for Artists for Designing Downtown Banners and the Wayfinding Project. And my last guest was Sherry McDonald with updates about art classes and art workshops sponsored by the Color Wheel. On tomorrow's show, find out about the Blue Line Club with Arnold Liebolt. And Troy Quinn will be here to highlight this weekend's symphony concerts. We'll talk with Becky Roth about Rock, Juno's Spread of Happiness. And we'll get a preview of this week's Juno World Affairs Council's presentation by Philip Yun. So that's tomorrow live at 3 on KTOO, and Juno Afternoon is repeated at 4 on KRNN and available online on demand at ktoo.org. Jeff Brown is the producer, and I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. And once again, today's show will be available on demand online at ktoo.org. Until tomorrow, this has been a Juno Afternoon. Have a great Juno evening.
Broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on Translators K276.